Fog was dangerous, especially in crowded waters like these. But it also afforded protection from submarines. In heavy fog, only chance could bring a submarine commander close enough to a ship to see it through his periscope or from his conning tower, and if he was that close, he was too close, at great risk of collision. As long as the fog persisted, Captain Turner had little cause to worry about U-boats. At 11 o'clock, the fog began to dissipate. In the crow's nest, Thompson and Clinton now had the extraordinary experience of moving through the dispersing fog as if flying in an aircraft through clouds. At intervals, sun warmed their perch and leavened the morning chill. Sometime between 11 and noon, Thompson caught his first sight of the Irish coast. He was able to see it over the top of the fog, but only with his binoculars. And even then the terrain was obscured by mist. What he saw, he said later, was just the loom of the land through the haze. He called out to the bridge below, "Land on the port beam!" The fog continued to fade, and soon the decks were bathed in a yellowing mist that foretold sunshine to come. In London, a mosaic of information had by now accumulated in Blinker Hall's intelligence division and in Room 40 that showed that only one submarine was in the waters off County Cork, and that it had to be U-20, commanded by Captain Walter Schwieger, a talented and aggressive commander. As the morning progressed, more information arrived in the form of two messages that provided additional details about the demise of the Centurion. The ship had been attacked at 1 p.m. Thursday. All 44 of its crew were rescued after spending 10 hours at sea in lifeboats. One message stated, "Number and directions of submarine unknown." But by then, news about the attacks on the Centurion, the Candidate, and the schooner Earl of Latham was already in Liverpool newspapers. Alfred Allen Booth, chairman of Cunard, learned of the attacks while reading his morning paper over breakfast at his home. The meaning was clear, at least to him. He knew his company's flagship was due to travel the same waters that very day. Booth quit breakfast and rushed to see the senior naval officer at Liverpool, Captain Harry Stileman, and pleaded with him to take measures to protect the Lusitania. Booth urged that a message be sent to Turner, notifying him that the two Harrison Line ships had been torpedoed and sunk. Under war rules, Booth was not himself empowered to send a warning, or any other command, directly to Turner. At the start of the war, all ships of British registry came under the dominion of the Admiralty's Trade Division to give the Admiralty maximum flexibility in commandeering ships for military use, as well as to prevent confusion that might arise if conflicting orders were sent to a ship from both its owners and the Admiralty, a circumstance that Cunard Chairman Alfred Booth conceded could be very dangerous. Exactly what else occurred during Booth's meeting with Admiral Stileman is unclear, but Booth came away believing that a detailed message would be sent and that the Admiralty would order the Lusitania to divert to Queenstown, well short of Liverpool, until the immediate U-boat threat was past. Off Ireland, the Lusitania moved through pockets of fog, but visibility improved by the minute, and the threat of collision rapidly receded. Turner ordered the foghorn deactivated. Now, however, the risk of detection by a submarine increased. Anxiety on the bridge rose sharply with the arrival at 11:30 a.m. of a wireless message from the Admiralty, which stated, "Submarines active in southern part of Irish Channel, last heard of 20 miles south of Koningsberg light vessel." The sender added, "Make certain Lusitania gets this." The Koningsberg light vessel was dead ahead on Turner's course, just before the narrowest expanse, 45 miles across of the St. George's Channel. The message also indicated there was more than one submarine. If the submarines, plural, were in fact 20 miles south of the lightship, they were positioned about halfway across the channel. On a clear day, and by now the fog was nearly gone, the smoke from the Lusitania's three operating funnels would be visible for 20 miles in any direction, meaning a lookout on a submarine at the center of the channel would have an excellent chance of spotting the ship. The warning described the submarines as being active. But what exactly did active mean? The message was apparently the product of Chairman Booth's plea, but it fell short of what he had asked for. Only 18 words long, it conveyed no details about what had occurred over the previous 24 hours. Captain Turner, the one man at that moment who needed details the most, never learned of the loss of the two Harrison Line vessels and the Earl of Latham. With the fog now dissipated, Turner brought his speed up to 18 knots. He ordered maximum pressure maintained in his three available boiler rooms in the event a sudden burst of speed became necessary. At noon, as per Charles Laureate's request, the steward assigned to his cabin arrived to awaken him. The steward told Laureate the ship had picked up Cape Clear, a familiar landmark at the southwest tip of Ireland, and that the ship's time had been set ahead to Greenwich Mean Time. Laureate got out of bed, put on his knickerbocker suit, and was up on deck by 12:50. He knew the time because he checked his wristwatch, set as always to Boston time, and calculated the Greenwich equivalent. Lunch for first-class passengers began at 1 o'clock. He wanted to take a 10-minute stroll first. He noted that the ship seemed to be loafing along, and saw as well that the results of the mileage pool, posted at noon, showed the ship had traveled only 484 miles. Although Laureate found this slow, in fact, it worked out to an average of slightly more than 20 knots, and that included several hours through fog at 15. Still, this was well below the 25-knot pace he had expected the ship to maintain. It was a beautiful day then. Light wind, a smooth sea, and bright sunshine, Laureate wrote. Along the port side he saw the good old Irish coast. The coast, though, was still a long way off, merely a green slash on the horizon. The fine weather made Laureate uneasy. I thought to myself that if a German submarine really meant business, she would have to wait weeks for a more ideal chance than the present weather conditions. With a flat, unbroken sea such as that around us, the periscope of a submarine could certainly carry a long distance. The smoothness of the sea was the remarkable thing. Laureate likened it to a pancake. One of the ship's bellboys said it was just flat as a billiard table. Connecticut passenger Jane McFarquhar climbed to one of the upper decks and looked out over the glittering seascape. She and her 16-year-old daughter had just finished setting out the clothes they would wear upon arrival in Liverpool the next morning. They planned to leave their current outfits behind on the ship. The view was grand, McFarquhar said, the sun shining, the water smooth, and land visible on either side. As I gazed around the beautiful scene, I thought, where is this spoken of danger? The end of our voyage is almost in view, and we have had no sign of danger whatever. On Friday morning, Schwieger kept U-20 on the surface to continue recharging its batteries. He stood atop the conning tower. The sea was quilted with fog, but here and there sunlight gleamed through. Visibility improved quickly. The sea was flat, under a one-knot breeze. All of a sudden, visibility has become very good, Schwieger wrote in his log. While this gave him a long view of the surrounding sea, It also provided that view to any British patrol boat or destroyer that happened to be in the vicinity. The flatness of the surface increased the danger that enemy lookouts would spot U-20, even when submerged to periscope depth, for the feathery white wake of Schwieger's periscope would be visible for miles. And in fact, a trawler off in the distance now began moving in U-20's direction. Schwieger ordered a fast dive and raised his periscope. The vessel approached slowly, in a manner he found unsettling. "Therefore," he wrote, "we dive to a depth of 24 meters to get away from the trawler." The time was 10:30 a.m. "At 12 p.m., he wrote, "I shall rise again to a depth of 11 meters and take a periscopic observation." But shortly before that was to happen, at 11:50 a.m., a surge of excitement passed through the submarine. Even 80 feet below the surface, the men in U-20 could hear the sound of a ship overhead, transmitted through the hull. Schwieger wrote in his log, "A vessel with a very heavy engine passes over our boat." From the sound, Schwieger knew it was neither a destroyer nor a trawler, but something far larger, moving fast. It passed directly above, confirming the prudence of cruising at a depth that cleared even the largest ship's keels. Schwieger waited a few minutes, then returned to periscope depth to try to identify the ship. With the foghorn off and the sun high and bright, the Lusitania's passengers took to the open decks to play shuffleboard, throw medicine balls, and take part in other deck games. Older children played jump rope, as always. The youngest paraded the decks with nannies and stewardesses, on foot or in prams, with their sucking tubes hung around their necks or affixed to their clothing. In the shaded portions of the deck, and in those areas exposed to the 18-knot breeze generated by the ship's forward motion, it was still cool enough to require coats. One woman wore a large black fur. This being the last full day of the voyage, with the sun so bright and the air so clear, passengers seemed to take a special effort to dress well and with a little flair. A 7-year-old girl wore a pink and white striped cotton frock under a black velvet coat lined with red silk, then added a gold ring, a red coral necklet, and a mother-of-pearl brooch. The coat imparted to her the look of a red-winged blackbird. Pink seemed to be a popular color, for boys. One 5-year-old boy tore around in a pink wool coat over a checked jacket and knickers. A man in his late 20s dressed with clear intent to dazzle. He wore blue serge trousers, striped cotton shirt, Anderson Brothers, Makers, 27 Bridge Street, Glasgow, white merino pants, light lace-up boots, stamped inside with Holaber Brothers, 501 West 14th Street, New York. Gray socks with light blue soles, light-colored suspenders, leather belt and nickel buckle, and this, a pink merino vest. Many passengers settled into deck chairs to read, just as they'd done over the preceding 6 days. Dwight Harris sat on deck for a time, reading a book about the Medicis, then went to the purser's office to retrieve his engagement ring, his other jewels, and the $500 in gold that he had parked there at the start of the voyage. He went to his cabin and used a watch chain to hang several pieces around his neck, including the ring. "I pinned the big diamond brooch inside the pocket of my coat," he wrote, "and before leaving my cabin, unlocked the camera bag that held my life belt." This was the belt he had bought at Wanamaker's in New York the day before sailing. Harris had not yet run out of exclamation points. "I put the gold in my trousers pocket and then went down to lunch." Despite the calm weather, Kansas City passenger Theodore Nash was seasick, as he had been throughout the voyage. He urged his wife, Belle, to go up on deck without him to see the Irish coast and its islands in sunshine. He knew from past experience how lovely the view was. Bell at first demurred. I replied that his word was enough. I would see them when we returned, and if fog prevented, pictures would satisfy me. But Theodore insisted, and she obliged. She was glad that she had. A lovelier day cannot be imagined. The air was warm, no wind, bright sun, smooth sea. Throughout the ship there was that mix of sorrow and expectation that always marked the end of a voyage, but now it was joined by the relief of having made it to England safe and sound. On the bridge, Turner received a new message from the Admiralty that confused things further. Submarines 5 miles south of Cape Clear, proceeding west when sighted at 10 a.m. The Lusitania had already passed Cape Clear. If correct, this message indicated the threat might also be passed. The submarines, plural again, were behind and heading out to sea. Captain Turner congratulated himself on apparently missing these in the fog. He knew that even if their commanders now spotted the smoke from the ship's funnels and turned around, they would have no hope of catching up. While this offered some comfort, there was still the matter of the earlier report of submarines active in the St. George's Channel, south of the Koningsberg light vessel, dead ahead. At his periscope, Schwieger made a fast 360-degree sweep of the sea, then rotated the apparatus until he found the ship that had just passed overhead. It was a prize indeed, and not just in terms of tonnage. Long and narrow, with a razor bow, it sliced easily through the flat sea. Its funnels blew thick black smoke that showed its engine crew were working hard to achieve maximum speed. Schwieger did not need his war pilot, Lance, to help identify this ship. It was a large armored cruiser, British, of about 6,000 tons. He let it go. He had no choice. At his top submerged speed of 9 knots, Schwieger had no chance of catching the cruiser. Even his surface maximum of 15 knots would not have helped, for the cruiser was speeding away at what he estimated to be 18 knots. And had Schwieger for some reason been foolhardy enough to try surfacing, the warship's guns would have sunk his boat within minutes. Schwieger followed anyway, at periscope depth, in case the cruiser happened to change its course in a manner that would allow him to overtake it and launch an attack. But the ship ran at top speed, zigzagging, and soon was far in the distance. Schwieger later told his friend Valentiner how, at this point, exasperated, he unleashed a torrent of profanity. After the early days of the war, Valentiner explained, you rarely had a chance to loose a torpedo at any warship as big as a cruiser, and many a U-boat never caught sight of one during the entire war. The British Navy, like its German counterpart, kept its big warships locked safely away and did not send them roaming around to act as good targets for U-boats. The ship was, in fact, the HMS Juno, an old cruiser now serving as a coastal patrol vessel. It was based in Queenstown and was speeding back to port precisely because of the latest submarine alerts issued by the Admiralty. As it traveled, its crew took a routine measure of water temperature and found it to be 55 degrees Fahrenheit. After I was through swearing, Schwieger told Valentiner, I noticed that the fog was lifting. Presently, I could see blue sky. Schwieger recorded the encounter at 12:15 p.m. Half an hour later, he surfaced and returned to his westward course to continue his voyage home. Conservation of fuel was now a priority. He could not delay. The journey back to Emden would take another week. By now the weather had cleared to a degree that was almost startling. Unusually good visibility, Schwieger noted. Very beautiful weather. On the horizon, something new caught his eye. London, Washington. The King's Question. In London, on Friday, Colonel House, still acting in his role as President Wilson's unofficial emissary, met with Sir Edward Grey, Britain's Foreign Secretary, and the two traveled to the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew for a walk among the garden's beds of spring flowers, its alleys or vistas of cedars, and its most celebrated structure, the Palm House, an immense conservatory built of glass and iron, said to have influenced the design of London's Crystal Palace. The two men discussed the submarine war. "We spoke of the probability of an ocean liner being sunk," House wrote, "and I told him if this were done, a flame of indignation would sweep across America, which would in itself probably carry us into war." Oddly enough, the subject came up again a couple of hours later, when Colonel House paid a call on King George V at Buckingham Palace. The King turned to House at one point and asked, "Suppose they should sink the Lusitania with American passengers aboard?" Early that morning, Churchill, having concluded his naval negotiations with his French and Italian counterparts, left Paris on his journey to the headquarters of Britain's forces in France at Saint-Omer, where Sir John French was planning an offensive against German forces at Aubert, despite a severe shortage of artillery shells. Seeking to experience battle firsthand, Churchill hoped to get as close to the front as possible, while not, as he put it, incurring unjustifiable risks. He saw shell fire and smoke, but little else. Without actually taking part in the assault, it was impossible to measure the real conditions, he wrote. To see them, you had to feel them, and feeling them might well feel nothing more. To stand outside was to see nothing. To plunge in was to be dominated by personal experiences of an absorbing kind. He received his most vivid sense of the war at a casualty clearing station in a convent at Merville, about 40 miles east of headquarters, where men suffering from every form of horrible injury, seared, torn, pierced, choking, dying, were being sorted according to their miseries. Ambulance after ambulance pulled up at the door. The dead were carried out the back and buried. As Churchill passed the operating theater, he saw doctors at work trepanning a soldier, that is, cutting a hole in his skull. "Everywhere was blood and bloody rags," Churchill wrote. At the White House, with a fresh spring Friday in the offing, Wilson wrote again to Edith. She had come to dinner the night before, and he was feeling far more optimistic about the possibility of one day marrying her. "In this clear morning air," he wrote, "the world seems less in the way, seems less to stand between us." The Irish Sea. Funnels on the horizon. U-20 moved through a blue-on-blue morning. The fog was gone, the sky was empty of clouds, the sea was still. Schwieger trained his binoculars, his Zeiss God's Eyes, on a smudge at the horizon, and was startled to see a forest of masts and stacks, as he later described it to Max Valentiner. "At first I thought they must belong to several ships," he said. "Then I saw it was a great steamer coming over the horizon. It was coming our way. I dived at once, hoping to get a shot at it." In his log, at 1:20 p.m., Schwieger wrote, "Ahead and to starboard, four funnels and two masts of a steamer with course triangular to us comes into sight. Coming from south-southwest, it steered towards Galleyhead." ship is made out to be a large passenger steamer. Once at periscope depth, Schwieger ordered his maximum submerged speed, 9 knots, and set a course converging with that of the steamer. The ship was still miles off, however. When the liner was 2 miles away, it veered onto a new course that further widened the gap. Frustrated again, Schwieger wrote, "I had no hope now, even if we hurried at our best speed, of getting near enough to attack her." Schwieger followed anyway, just as he had done earlier with the cruiser Juno, in case the liner happened to make another course change that would bring it back onto a converging trajectory. He called for his pilot, Lance, to come to the periscope to take a look. Why he felt the need to do so is unclear. The ship was one of the most distinctive on the high seas, and a prize of the first order. He was near despair. This one ship by itself would have given him his best monthly tonnage count of the war. The day remained startlingly clear and still. This meant that Schwieger could not keep the periscope raised for long, lest it be detected by the target's lookouts, or worse, by a destroyer on patrol. In weather this clear and with seas this smooth, there'd be little chance for escape. On 2 previous occasions, the wake cast by his periscope on a flat sea had forced him to abort attacks. One would-be target, a Royal Mail steamer, had turned toward him with obvious intent to ram, causing him to order a fast dive and full speed away. Lance entered the control room. At about the same moment, something happened that Schwieger deemed the equivalent of a miracle. On the Lusitania's bridge, Captain Turner faced a dilemma that nothing in his long experience at sea had prepared him to manage. If the morning's wireless messages were correct, there were U-boats directly ahead of him and behind. On top of this, he faced a timing problem. Liverpool at this point still lay about 250 nautical miles ahead. At the entrance to the city's harbor lay the notorious Mersey Bar, which he could pass only at high tide. If Turner accelerated and proceeded at the highest speed he could achieve with only 3 boiler rooms in operation, or 21 knots, he would arrive far too early. With stopping out of the question, he would be forced to circle in the Irish Sea, smoke billowing from the ship's 3 operating funnels in open invitation to any submarine within a radius of 20 miles. There was another dimension to the problem. The time was now just past noon. No matter what speed Turner traveled, he would end up having to pass through the St. George's Channel at night, with fog and ever-present danger. As it was, the fog that had enclosed the ship all morning had left Turner with a less precise sense of his location than he would have liked. Compounding this impression was the fact that he was farther from the coast than usual, about 20 miles, when in fine weather he might come as close as 1 mile. He called his 2 most senior officers to the bridge, Staff Captain Anderson and First Officer John Preston Piper, to ask their advice, and at length reached a decision. First, he would pinpoint his location. The Irish coast was by now visible, but the ship's distance from shore was difficult to reckon precisely. Being a sailor of the old school, Turner liked to use a procedure known as a 4-point bearing. This would require him to run parallel to the coast at a steady speed for roughly 30 minutes, while First Officer Piper took 4 bearings off a single shore landmark, in this case, the lighthouse atop the old head. Once Turner knew his precise position, he planned to maintain a speed of 18 knots so that he would arrive at the Mersey Bar early the next morning, at just the right time to enter the harbor without pause. Though slower than the 21 knots his 3 operating boiler rooms would allow, it was still faster than any other merchant ship then in service, and certainly faster than any submarine. Turner planned as well to alter his course later in the day to bring the Lusitania closer to shore, so that he would pass near the Koningsberg light vessel before entering the narrowest portion of the St. George's Channel. He understood that this contravened the Admiralty's advisory that captains pass lightships and other navigational markers at mid-channel, but the Admiralty had reported submarines 20 miles south of the lightship, a location that any mariner traversing that 45-mile-wide stretch would have described as mid-channel. To follow the Admiralty's advisory would have meant sailing directly toward the waiting submarines. At about 1:30 p.m., Captain Turner ordered the officer at the helm to make a turn to starboard, to bring the ship in line with the coast, so that Piper could take the first of the four bearings. This turn, and several previous course changes, persuaded some passengers that Turner was directing the ship on a zigzag course to evade submarines, though in fact he was not. Paradoxically, owing to the shape of the coastline, the turn would have seemed to passengers like a turn toward open sea. Measles-racked Robert Kay peered through his porthole in quarantine. The Bronx boy, now spotted and inflamed, watched the world pass, his only diversion. The day outside was full of sunshine and sparkle, the Irish coast a vivid green. But as he watched, the ship began its turn to starboard, and to his great disappointment, the land began to recede. That morning, Champagne King George Kessler followed through on his decision to talk to Captain Turner about including passengers in the ship's drills. The two men smoked as they talked. Kessler wrote, "I suggested that the passengers should be given tickets with a number denoting the number of the boat they should make for in case anything untoward happened, and that it seemed to me this detail would minimize the difficulties in the event of trouble." Turner told him that the idea had come up in the wake of the Titanic disaster, but that Cunard had rejected it as impractical. He added that he did not have the authority to institute the practice on his own without first getting approval from the Admiralty's Board of Trade. The conversation shifted to the torpedo scare, which neither of us regarded as of any moment, Kessler recalled. Turner may have downplayed his own concerns to put Kessler at ease. Just as Pilot Lance arrived at U-20's periscope, Schwieger saw the giant steamer change course again, this time to starboard. "She was coming directly at us," Schwieger told Valentina. "She could not have steered a more perfect course if she had deliberately tried to give us a dead shot." The time was 1:35 p.m. The ship's new heading suggested it was bound for Queenstown. Schwieger set a course that would put U-20 in front of the ship at a 90-degree angle. He ordered full ahead, and for the next 25 minutes sped forward on an intersecting course, as the ship grew steadily larger in his viewfinder. "A short, fast run, and we waited," he told Valentina. Although this patrol had affirmed Schwieger's distrust of torpedoes, he had no choice but to use one. His deck gun would have been useless against such a large vessel, and dangerous, for after the first couple of shells, the big ship likely would have turned and run, or even attempted to ram his boat. Schwieger selected a G6 torpedo. Within the submarine, the tension mounted. All the ship had to do was make another turn away from U-20, and the chase would be over. Queenstown was near. There was also the possibility the ship's lookouts would spot Schwieger's periscope, and that its captain would summon a pride of destroyers. Strangely, the ship had no escorts whatsoever. Even stranger, in Schwieger's view, was that the vessel was in these waters at all, especially after his two successful attacks the day before. That the ship was not sent through the North Channel is inexplicable, he wrote in his log. Schwieger ordered the torpedo set to run at a depth of 3 meters, about 10 feet. He had not yet had time to let Lance take a look at the target. The big ship continued its approach, its giant hull black against the otherwise gleaming seascape. Schwieger's firing crew armed the torpedo and flooded its tube. The Lusitania was now about 16 hours from Liverpool, or, put another way, 3 meals out, one lunch, one dinner, and on Saturday, a last breakfast in Liverpool Harbor. Now came the lunch. First-class passengers had only one seating, in the dining saloon at the center of the ship under the Great Dome. Second class had two, at 12:30 and 1:30. Over lunch there was talk of the talent show the night before, and of the latest war news published in the ship's daily Cunard Bulletin, and of course of the fact that the ship was now well into the war zone. Charles Laureate went to lunch with Lothrop Withington, as always, and they sat at their usual table in the first-class saloon. Laureate noted that portholes on either side of the room were open. He was certain of this, he said later, because the unusual warmth of the day had conjured an annoyance that had plagued the two men throughout the voyage. Owing to the warm weather, the stewards had opened portholes throughout the dining room and turned on a large electric fan positioned directly over Laureate's table, thereby creating a draft that was strong enough to be irritating. The same thing had happened several times previously during the voyage, and each time, as now, Laureate felt compelled to ask the steward to turn the fan off. Otherwise, the lunch was a pleasant one. The two men looked forward to the ship's arrival. "We had a jolly time together," Laureate wrote, "and made plans for seeing each other in London, as his rooms were near our London office." It was clear now that the unexpectedly slow pace of the Lusitania would cost Laureate a day's work in London, but soon enough he'd be handing off the Dickens Christmas Carol and meeting with Thackeray's daughter, Lady Ritchie, to plan the notes she would write for each of the 118 drawings still locked in the shoe-case in his cabin. Next he would meet with the framers and binders who would transform those drawings into items worth far more than the paltry $4,500 he had paid for them. Elsewhere in the dining room, Theodate Pope and her companion Edwin Friend were finishing up their lunch. A young Englishman at our table had been served with his ice cream and was waiting for the steward to bring him a spoon to eat it with, Theodate recalled. He looked ruefully at it and said he would hate to have a torpedo get him before he ate it. We all laughed and then commented on how slowly we were running. We thought the engines had stopped. The ship, however, was still moving at a brisk 18 knots. This perception of slowness was likely caused by the fact that the sea was so smooth, which reduced the level of vibration transmitted through the hull. Dwight Harris, with his engagement ring hanging snug under his shirt, joined his usual luncheon companions, but did not share the cheerful anticipation that colored the talk around him. He was ill at ease, uncannily so. He wrote, "While at table I had a most intense nervous feeling come over me, and I got up and left without finishing my lunch." He went to his stateroom, A9, to get his coat and hat and his Medici book, and went back out on deck to read. Medical student Preston Pritchard and his roommate Arthur Gadsden were very much aware of the ship's entry into the danger zone. They had become friends during the voyage and talked often, owing to the fact that both had the upper berths in their room. On Friday, Pritchard and Gadsden spent part of the morning talking about submarines and wondering if we should see one at all, never having the least fear but what we should get away from them, Gadsden wrote. Shortly after noon, Pritchard walked to the smoking lounge to join the other men who had gathered there to see the results of the mileage pool, and then set off to the second-class dining saloon for lunch. As usual, he sat opposite Grace French. Today there seemed to be a certain charge between Pritchard and Miss French. He wore his green suit, not his best blue, but handsome was handsome, and after 6 days in the sun and weather, Pritchard was very handsome indeed. He mentioned to Grace that he had seen a young woman aboard who could be her double, and that he had even gone up to this other woman to start a conversation before realizing his mistake. This was not merely a flirty line meant to ignite conversation. One or two of the other men at the table had encountered the same woman and had done likewise. "Pritchard volunteered to point her out for me after lunch," Grace recalled. "I agreed, and went down for my hat and coat." One of the ship's stewards noted that Pritchard left the dining room around 1:20 p.m. As Miss French was making her way back up the stairs to meet Pritchard, she ran into two shipboard friends who asked where she was going. I replied that Mr. Pritchard was going to present me to my double and passed on. I then joined him, and we walked around laughing at the idea. I said to him, "I wonder if I could recognize this girl myself." They joked as they hunted. The time passed happily, and then it was 2:09 p.m. The sun shone, the sea glittered. Schwieger estimated his target's speed at 22 knots, 25 miles an hour, and gauged its range at 700 meters, just under half a mile. If his calculations were correct, the torpedo would strike the ship at an ideal angle of 90 degrees. At 2:10 p.m., Schwieger gave the order to fire. The torpedo burst from the submarine in what Schwieger called a clean bow shot, and soon reached a speed of about 44 miles an hour. At that rate, it would reach the target's hull in 35 seconds. With the sea so smooth, the possibility of the torpedo's track being discovered was high. Each passing second reduced the likelihood that the ship would be able to turn hard enough and fast enough to evade it. But still, for Schwieger and his men, those 35 seconds constituted a long interval. Schwieger watched through his periscope. He didn't realize it yet, but he had erred in his calculation of the target's speed. In fact, it was moving more slowly than he had gauged, by 4 knots, or roughly 5 miles an hour. Lusitania. Beauty. Shortly before 2 o'clock, scores of crewmen were gathered in the baggage room at the Lusitania's bow on F-deck, half coming on duty, half coming off. The task at hand was to get the thousands of pieces of passenger luggage ready for arrival. Seaman Morton spent 2 hours helping load suitcases and trunks onto the electric elevator that provided the only access to the room. The shifts changed at 2 o'clock, 4 bells, when Morton was to begin a 2-hour stint as a special lookout to watch for submarines. He was assigned to the forecastle, or forecastle, the portion of the main deck just behind the bow. "At 4:05, he said, "I went on deck to put my sweater and gear ready for going on the lookout at 2 o'clock. My place was extra lookout right up in the eyes of the ship on deck, my responsibility being the starboard side of the bow from ahead to the beam." By now the ship had expended about 6,000 tons of coal, and the bunkers that ran the length of the hull on both the port and the starboard sides were for the most part empty tunnels, grimed with coal dust and pierced here and there by portals through which men known as trimmers moved the coal to the furnaces. On the bridge, Captain Turner ordered the helmsman to hold the ship on its course parallel to shore so that his first officer could continue the 4-point bearing. The protective screen of fog had by now wholly dissipated. All lookouts had been warned to keep a sharp lookout and report anything that appeared suspicious, said Thomas Mahoney, a seaman who was sharing the noon to 2 p.m. watch. "At approximately 1:50 p.m., we spotted an object 2 points on the starboard bow, conical in shape. It looked to him like a buoy. We reported it to the officer of the watch, and it caused a little commotion on the bridge over what it might be. A seaman named Hugh Johnston, quartermaster, was at this point just taking over the helm, his trick at the wheel. The bridge was crowded with officers, who also were changing watch. Soon after Johnston took the wheel, he heard the cry that something had been spotted off the starboard bow. A number of officers raised binoculars and speculated that the object might indeed be a buoy, or a porpoise, or a fragment of drifting debris. No one expressed concern. "We carried on," said Johnston. At 2 o'clock, Seaman Leslie Morton took his position in the forecastle. He stood on the starboard side. Another seaman scanned the waters off the port side. 4 other lookouts were stationed elsewhere on the ship, including in the crow's nest. Morton's brother lay below decks sleeping, so as to be ready for his own shift later in the day. Half the ship's crew was still gathered in the luggage bay. The ship sliced through the calm like a razor through gelatin. Morton was so intent on doing his job well that he started seeing a dozen things every few minutes. By 2 o'clock, the second-class passengers assigned to the second lunch seating were midway through their meals. First-class passengers rode between decks aboard the ship's 2 electric elevators, which were powered by the ship's dynamo. A group of children was jumping rope on an upper deck with the help of a member of the engineering crew, John Brennan, a trimmer. The weather by now was perfect, the day vividly clear. So lovely that families from Queenstown and Kinsale had gathered on the old head to picnic in the balmy air and watch the passage of ships. They could just see the Lusitania about 20 miles off, her funnels pouring smoke into the sky. For Morton, in the ship's eyes, the vista off to starboard toward open sea was clear and bright. "At 2:10, he said, "I looked at my watch, and putting it into my pocket, I glanced round the starboard side, and, as roughly as I could judge, I saw a big burst of foam about 500 yards away, 4 points on the starboard bow. It looked to him like a giant bubble bursting onto the surface. An instant later, he saw something moving across the flat plain of the sea, a track as clear as if it had been made by an invisible hand with a piece of chalk on a blackboard. He reached for his megaphone. Captain Turner left the bridge and went below to his quarters. At about 1:30, Quartermaster Johnston, no longer at the wheel, was sent below to give Turner a message that the old head of Kinsale was now 10 points on the port bow and 20 miles away. The ship's course was taking it gradually closer to the coast. Johnston returned to the bridge. Half an hour later, just after 2 o'clock, he heard the cry, "Here is a torpedo coming!" After finishing lunch and parting from his friend Lothrop Withington, Charles Laureate went down to his cabin to get a sweater. He put it on under the jacket of his knickerbocker suit, then headed back up for a real walk. He climbed the main companionway and walked out onto the port side of the ship, with the Irish coast visible in the distance. Here he ran into Elbert Hubbard, the writer, and his wife Alice. Hubbard joked that he probably would not be welcome in Germany, given a pamphlet he had written entitled "Who Lifted the Lid Off Hell," in which he laid blame for the war on Kaiser Wilhelm. He had given Laureate a copy earlier in the voyage. Laureate described it as a piece of vitriolic English. On B deck, starboard side, Theodate Pope stood beside her companion Edwin Friend, leaning on the rail and admiring the sea, which was a marvelous blue and very dazzling in the sunlight. There was so much glare that Theodate wondered aloud, how could the officers ever see a periscope? Oliver Bernard, the set designer, was standing in the veranda café, leaning lazily against a window, looking out at the view. He saw what seemed to be the tail of a fish, well off the starboard side. Next, a streak of froth began arcing across the surface toward the ship. An American woman came up beside him and said, "That isn't a torpedo, is it?" "I was too spellbound to answer," he said. "I felt absolutely sick." Here it was, this thing everyone had feared. We had all been thinking, dreaming, eating, sleeping submarine from the hour we left New York, and yet, with the dreaded danger upon us, I could hardly believe the evidence of my own eyes. "There was little fear," Bernard said. "I did not think that anybody, even women and children, were so much terrified as they were astounded and stunned by the consciousness that the fears, cherished half in ridicule for 5 days previous, had at last been realized. The German bluff had actually come off." The track continued its approach. That first turmoil, that first bubble of foam, was the expulsion of compressed air from the submarine's launching tube as the torpedo exited. The torpedo itself was 20 feet long and 20 inches in diameter. Its nose, shaped like the top of a corn silo, contained 350 pounds of TNT and an explosive called hexanite. Though German commanders typically set the depth at 15 feet, this one traveled at 10 feet. It moved at about 35 knots, or 40 miles an hour, powered by compressed air stored in a tank toward its nose, just behind the compartment that contained the explosives. The air rushed against the pistons in its engine, geared to spin two propellers, one clockwise, the other counterclockwise, to keep the torpedo from rolling and veering. The air was then exhausted into the sea, where it bubbled to the surface. These bubbles needed a few seconds to rise, which meant the torpedo itself was always well ahead of the track that appeared above. As the torpedo advanced, the water rushing past its nose turned a small propeller, which unscrewed a safety device that prevented detonation during storage. This propeller slipped from the nose and fell to the sea bottom, thereby exposing a triggering mechanism that, upon impact with a ship's hull, would fire a small charge into the larger body of explosives. A gyroscope kept the torpedo on course, adjusting for vertical and horizontal deflection. The track lingered on the surface like a long, pale scar. In maritime vernacular, this trail of fading disturbance, whether from ship or torpedo, was called a dead wake. The smoothness of the sea presented some passengers with a view of the torpedo that was startling in its clarity. Dwight Harris, his Medici book in hand, was walking toward the stern along the starboard side when something caught his eye. He wrote, "I saw the torpedo coming, a white and greenish streak in the water. I stood transfixed." Passenger James Brooks, a chain salesman who came from Connecticut, was walking along the boat deck when friends on the next deck up, the Marconi deck, called to him to join them for a round of shuffleboard. These friends were Mr. and Mrs. Montague Grant of Chicago. He climbed the stairs, and as he walked toward them across the upper deck, he saw a foam trail moving fast across the water. "Oh, yes, I saw the torpedo coming," and exclaimed, "Torpedo!" and rushed to the rail just aft of the staircase and stood on 1 foot and leaned forward, over, to watch the explosion which I expected to see occur on the outside of the ship. Any other man would have found this scene terrifying. Brooks was entranced. He saw the body of the torpedo moving well ahead of the wake through water he described as being a beautiful green. The torpedo was covered with a silvery phosphorescence, you might term it, which was caused by the air escaping from the motors. He said, "It was a beautiful sight." Had there been more time, had the idea of a torpedo attack against a civilian liner not seemed so incomprehensible, had submarine tactics and evasion stratagems been better understood, there would have been a chance, a tiny one, that Turner could have maneuvered the ship to lessen the damage or even avoid the torpedo altogether. He could have engaged the ship's reverse turbines, thereby slowing the ship and nullifying the calculations made by the submarine commander as to its range and speed, causing the torpedo to miss. He could also have taken advantage of the Lusitania's proven agility and ordered a full turn to port or starboard to dodge the oncoming torpedo or cause it to glance off the hull. In just 2 months, another Cunard captain, Daniel Dow, back at work, would do exactly that and win a citation from the company's board. On July 15, 1915, at dusk, a lookout aboard Dow's Mauritania spotted a periscope about half a mile out. An instant later, two torpedoes began racing toward his ship, their tracks clearly visible. He ordered an immediate full turn to starboard toward the submarine. Both torpedoes missed. The submarine submerged and fled. U-20. Treff. Schwieger's log entry for 2:10 p.m. May 7th began with the German word Treff for impact. He wrote, "Torpedo hits starboard side close behind the bridge. An unusually great detonation follows with a very strong explosive cloud. Cloud reaches far beyond the forward funnel. The explosion of the torpedo must have been accompanied by a second one. Boiler? Or coal? Or powder?" By now his pilot, Lantz, was standing next to him at the periscope. Schwieger stepped aside and let Lantz peer through the eyepiece. Lantz could identify ships, even small ones, by their silhouettes and deck configurations. This one was easy. An instant after looking through the eyepiece, Lantz said, "My God, it's the Lusitania." Schwieger's log indicates that he only now learned the ship's true identity. But this seems implausible. The ship's profile, its size, its lines, its four funnels, made it one of the most distinctive vessels afloat. Schwieger again took the periscope. What he saw now shocked even him. Part 4. The Black Soul. Lusitania. Impact. As the torpedo passed from view below the edge of the deck, there was an interval when nothing happened, and one could indulge the notion that it had missed or malfunctioned. "I saw it disappear," one passenger said, "and for a bare second we all had a kind of hope that maybe it wouldn't explode." In the next instant, 350 pounds of explosives detonated against the plates of the hull, at a point under the bridge about 10 feet below the waterline. Immediately the payload turned from solid to gas. This phase change released heat at a temperature exceeding 5,000 degrees centigrade, 9,000 degrees Fahrenheit, at immense pressure. As one early 20th century submarine builder put it, "The side of the ship is nothing but tissue paper in the hands of these enormous forces." A geyser of seawater, planking, rope, and shards of steel soared upward to twice the height of the ship. Lifeboat number 5 was blown to atoms, one lookout said. The ship continued forward through the geyser, which almost immediately collapsed back onto the decks. Seawater drenched passengers. Debris thudded off the shuffleboard courts. The children jumping rope on A deck stopped jumping. A hole the size of a small house now existed below the waterline. Its shape was more horizontal than vertical, roughly 40 feet wide by 15 feet high. The effects of the blast spread well beyond this, however. Thousands of rivets and the steel plates they anchored came loose over an area about 15 times greater than the hole itself. The glass in nearby portholes fractured. bulkheads were damaged and watertight doors dislodged. The relatively small doors and chambers of passenger ships did not dispel explosive forces as readily as the open holds of cargo vessels, and thus were prone to destruction. The Lusitania's builders had installed the